Let us pray. Loving God, everlasting Father, creator, sustainer, and redeemer of all the ends of the universe, thou whose love is so unspeakably great that we cannot comprehend it, thou who in the person of thy Son hast redeemed us unto thyself and made us the family of God, we come to thee in prayer at this moment, beseeching thy help and thy strength and thy power for our daily tasks. We remember in brokenness of heart all who grieve and are sad today, especially those in the world who are outcast and second class and downtrodden, those who are struggling for selfhood and human dignity, in some instances for nationhood and statehood. We know in our best moments that every upward reach of the human heart is God-given. We pray for all of these. We pray for the bereaved and saddened who suffer even now anguish because of oppression, very often at the hands of their own Christian brethren. We ask for thy strength in the church to be the church, truly the church of the Lord Jesus Christ. Bless us in this service today that we may honor thee with our thoughts, with our prayers, with our hymns of praise and adoration, and with the spoken message. All to the glory of Jesus Christ in the church and in the world. Amen. We of this seminary community are indeed grateful in the deepest sense of that word to two young South Carolina men who have made this Carver Barnes Memorial Lecture Series possible. At least one of these young men has attended these services this week, and we express to him our gratitude for this lecture series. Also to Dr. Robert Handy, we express our earnest thanks for a job well done and assure him that he has contributed very meaningfully to our covenant community this week. And we renew to him a warm and cordial invitation to come back at every opportunity to visit with us here at Southeastern. He belongs to us now, and we not only have benefited tremendously from his lectures this week, but have come to know him very warmly, most of us, those of us at least who have gotten a chance to spend a little time with him. We now claim him too and ask him please to accept our warm welcome at every possibility to return. We now hear him gladly as he lectures to us on the subject, Should Baptists Revise Traditional Views on Church and State? Dr. Handy.
Mrs. Coggin, Christian friends, may I express my appreciation for the most courteous and hospitable reception that I've enjoyed here this week. I'm grateful to President Binkley and Professor Scoggin and the many of you who have welcomed me. I've been encouraged to speak freely and frankly and have tried to do so. Even the public address system has been in my favor. The gentleman who attends it tells me that as the academic year wears on, he has to keep turning up the volume louder and louder. I've been somewhat more fortunate than the president of Colby College, who on one occasion found that the speaker failed him at a critical moment. A technician came out to help, and as the technician was leaving, he said in a loud stage whisper, which was picked up by the rejuvenated machine, "There's simply a screw loose in the speaker." Should Baptists revise traditional views on church and state? Now, as to what traditional views are, I mean those views which put heavy emphasis on the maintenance of an absolute wall of separation between church and state. In a recent book entitled Protestant Concepts of Church and State, which I'm sure many of you have read, a book by Thomas G. Sanders, there is a long chapter entitled Separationism, Defenders of the Wall. And Sanders' chief illustration of the separationists is we Baptists. He does note variations among us, but he traces our emphasis on the separation of church and state from our early history to the present moment. Baptists in America, he asserts, tend to absolutize church and state separation. Now please note that my topic is should Baptists revise traditional views on church and state? It's not should we revise traditional views on religious freedom. These are not the same thing. With, I suppose, all Baptists and most Protestants, and today increasing numbers of Orthodox and Roman Catholic Christians, I believe ever more firmly in religious liberty, religious freedom for all men and for all groups. And I think I believe this with you on biblical, theological, historical, philosophical, and practical grounds. But the topic does not deal with revising views on religious liberty, which has been a principal Baptist concern for centuries. But rather, it deals with the separation of church and state. My beloved colleague, Professor M. Cyril Bates, wrote several decades ago, Americans carelessly identify religious liberty with the separation of church and state, believing that the latter is the sole and necessary ground of the former. Now, to be sure, religious liberty and the separation of church and state bear an intimate relationship to each other, but they are not the same thing. And I think we make a contribution to clarity when we keep these things straight in our discussion. Now, to be sure, we Baptists traditionally see these things as very closely intertwined. Dr. Sanders, for example, observes, and I'm quoting, Baptists in America usually understand religious freedom in conjunction with the separation of church and state as an outgrowth of their very early refusal to accept mere toleration and their battle against privileges accorded to any denomination. Religious freedom through the separation of church and state was the greatest contribution of the Baptists, along with other groups, to the theory and practice of politics. Now, in part because of our history and our contributions, we tend to see liberty and separation as two sides of the same coin. And yet the principle is religious liberty. The separation of church and state is one way to help to maintain and defend it. Just a moment's reflection will remind us that there are situations where there has been separation of church and state without religious liberty in its fullness. Certain countries behind the Iron Curtain, for example, reflect that situation. And the neighboring country of Mexico, in certain periods of her history, has shown the same thing, separation, but without full religious liberty. And then also there are countries which claim to have genuine religious liberty, but in which there is maintained some form of established church, England, Scandinavia. Nevertheless, in our country, because of our particular pluralistic tradition, and in part because of our long history of a generally benevolent separation of church and state, separation has here been a bulwark of liberty. A milestone in the history of the separation of church and state, of course, was the passage of the First Amendment to the Constitution. Now, Baptists generally have been strong defenders of the First Amendment, with its historic provision in its religion clause that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. But now in mid-20th century, some Baptists, along with a good many others, Protestants and those who are non-Protestant, perhaps alarmed at trends toward secularism, have wondered if, after all, this is the proper way to safeguard certain historic values of American life. They have wondered if recent Supreme Court interpretations of the First Amendment are, after all, right. And some have participated in movements to make it clear that such things as the devotional reading of the Bible and prayer in public schools is not unconstitutional. And some of our numbers have joined in movements to perhaps prepare a new form of the religion clause of the First Amendment. Now, as a background for the question that I'm raising for us today, should Baptists revise traditional views on church and state? I suggest that we look once again briefly at the way the First Amendment was arrived at, that we remind ourselves of the general 19th century Protestant context in understanding the First Amendment, and finally that we consider how different the religious picture of our country today is from what it was in 1789, when the critical congressional debates on that First Amendment were held. Now, this material does, I think, provide us some important background for us as both individually and corporately. We will have to make some hard decisions about church-state matters in the 35 years that remain to us in the 20th century. I'm trying to provide here is some background for wrestling with this question. The topic of the day is a big one. Many things must be considered before we can settle it for ourselves. But as a church historian, I'm attempting to suggest some perspectives that may be helpful in our wrestling with this church-state matter at this juncture in our history. Now, I believe, and I'm going to attempt to say so before the end of the hour, I believe we must interpret the First Amendment, particularly the religion clauses, in the light of our present situation. But nevertheless, it is important for us to know what the First Amendment meant at the time of its passage. And I think we are not free to contradict its clear meaning, as long as it is a matter of law. If another amendment is adopted in its place, then we're in a different situation. But I think as long as that is the framework for our church-state thinking, then we are not free to contradict its clear meaning. Now, during the debates over the ratification of the Constitution of the United States, there was much demand, of course, for a Bill of Rights. And once the Constitution was ratified and in force, then national leaders, particularly Jefferson and Madison, turned their attention to preparing the first 10 amendments. And Madison introduced the matter of religion into the House of Representatives in June of 1789. And over the summer and into September, the debates were held in the House and the Senate, first House, the first Senate. The debates were held as a conclusion of which the First Amendment to the Constitution was prepared. Now, a very early form of the proposed religion clause read, "No religion shall be established by law, nor shall the equal rights of conscience be infringed." Now, we must remember that in 1789, there were still a number of state establishments of religion surviving, particularly in New England. Some feared that this form of an amendment would end those instantly, and indeed, some feared that this form of the amendment would abolish all religion. So after three changes, as a result of extended debates in the House, the House sent forward this proposal: Congress shall make no law establishing religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, nor shall the rights of conscience be infringed. The Senate took up the matter in September of 1789. A motion was made to have the religion clause read, Congress shall make no law establishing one religious sect or society in preference to others, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, nor shall the rights of conscience be infringed. Now this form obviously would have allowed multiple establishments. It would have prevented any one church being established, but it would have allowed multiple establishments where all churches alike might have received government support, government finance. Now, some have argued in our time that the First Amendment, as it is presently worded, does in fact permit this. But it seems to me that this implication was explicitly rejected 175 years ago. Several forms of the amendment which would have permitted this were specifically rejected in 1789. Now, to trace the total history here would be tedious. There were 7 proposals for change in all made as the Senate debated the religion clause of the First Amendment. One of the proposals read, Congress shall make no law establishing articles of faith or a mode of worship or prohibiting the free exercise of religion. This would have left the way open once again for financial support of religion by the government, just so long as no legal sanction was given to any one form of belief, any one creed, or any one particular form of worship. Now, the Senate did accept this, and the Senate thought this was the proper form for the First Amendment. Now, you'll notice in that last reading I gave, the clause about infringing rights of conscience was dropped. Some of the senators feared that, again, the state establishment would be undercut by this, so this clause they proposed be dropped. Now you ended up then with a different House and Senate version. The matter had to go to a joint committee between the two houses. The House yielded to the Senate on the last clause, the infringing rights of conscience clause, and that was let go. But they refused to give in on their original stance at prohibiting a national establishment of religion in any form. And so the final form was agreed on in joint committee. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So on the national level, there could be no established church, there could not be plural support for many religions or for all religion, nor could there be use of tax funds for one or many churches or again for religion in general. Now, many historical forces had worked together to bring about this result. The debates were complete in 1789. Ratification, of course, came finally in 1791. Many forces worked together to bring this about. One of the most important of these forces was the sheer fact of religious multiplicity, religious pluralism. The sheer presence of so many churches was certainly one, not the only one, but one of the forces making for this result. And yet the religious pluralism of that time was fundamentally a Protestant pluralism. Fundamentally, the multiplicity was a Protestant multiplicity. An estimate of the religious population of America at the close of the colonial period finds that there were 11 denominations of any size. Now, there were a number of small groups, with many of them in Pennsylvania. But there were 11 denominations of any size, ranging from the Congregationalists, who then had more than 700 congregations, 750, largely concentrated in New England, to the Roman Catholics, who were 11th then in size, by far the smallest of these 11, with just under 60 congregations at the close of the colonial period. Now, the first 10 of these 11 were Protestant denominations. Together, they had more than 3,000 congregations, whereas the Roman Catholics then had less than 60. This was overwhelmingly a Protestant pluralism. And those Roman Catholic churches were, of course, largely grouped in Pennsylvania and Maryland. The Roman Catholics were then a pretty tiny, persecuted minority, about 1% of the population. I should say, a minority just emerging from persecution. The Jewish population was very tiny indeed. One estimate has it that it was about 1/20 of 1% of the population of the country at the time. So the First Amendment means separation of church and state, but the nation's churches at that time were predominantly Protestant. Of the 11 denominations of any size, the first 10 were Protestant denominations. Now, the end of establishment on the national basis did not mean that the nation's religious leaders were giving up the idea of America's remaining or becoming even more a Christian and a Protestant nation. Sidney E. Meade, in his penetrating book, The Lively Experiment, has explained in detail that, and I'm quoting, establishment rested on two basic assumptions, that the existence and well-being of any society depends upon a body of commonly shared religious beliefs, the nature of man, his place in the cosmos, his destiny, and his conduct toward his fellow men, and that the only guarantee that these necessary beliefs will be sufficiently inculcated is to put the coercive power of the state behind the institution responsible for their definition, articulation, and inculcation. End of the quotation. Now, the triumph of religious freedom and the practice of the separation of church and state, which defends it, did not mean giving up the first assumption. To the overwhelming body of Protestants who supported, of Americans who supported the First Amendment, the triumph of religious freedom did not mean giving up that first assumption, that is, the necessity for a commonly shared body of basic religious ideas. What separation meant was the giving up of the second assumption, namely that the institutions responsible for inculcating this body of common religious ideas must have the coercive power of the state behind it. Protestants thought that by voluntary means, they would be able to secure more effectively the consent of the overwhelming majority of the population. So in the 19th century, Protestant denominations, arch rivals in many respects, set out largely through the channels of mass revivals and networks of voluntary, missionary, Bible, tract, and benevolent societies to make America a fully Protestant nation. They penetrated in the middle 19th century every aspect of our common life in their drive, making the middle decades of the 19th century more the American Protestant age than the colonial period with its established churches had been. I could produce 100 particulars in support of this general position. For example, Wilson Smith has noted, at few times in our history has the distinction between the religious and the secular been as clouded as in the three decades before the Civil War. Public men brought sectarian judgments to bear on their decisions. To no less a degree did churches and churchmen pursue secular issues in their councils with evangelic vigor and the assurances of piety. This was the American Protestant age when Protestant leaders dreamed that by voluntary means this was to be a fully Christian Protestant nation. In a very important article entitled The True American Union of Church and State, The True American Union of Church and State, James F. McClear has shown how American Protestants, and he particularly focused upon New England Congregationalists by way of illustration, could embrace at one and the same time the separation of church and state as provided for under the First Amendment and the purpose of making the United States a broadly confessional republic. This was the dream, that under the conditions of freedom, they could by voluntary means make America fully a Christian nation. And Dr. McClear, who brings many particulars to illustrate his point, quotes, for example, from one of the conspicuous leaders of mid-19th century life, Professor Bella Bates Edwards. He said, "Perfect religious liberty does not imply that the government of the country is not a Christian government. The Christian Sabbath is here recognized by the civil authorities. Most, if not all, our constitutions proceed on the basis of the truth of the Christian religion. Christianity has been affirmed to be part and parcel of the law of the land. There is convincing evidence to show that this real, though indirect, connection between the state and Christianity is every year acquiring additional strength, is attended with less and less of exception and remonstrance. It was in 1848 that Professor Edwards made that statement. Perfect religious liberty does not imply that the government of the country is not a Christian government. Now, all this took place, you see, after separation, after the First Amendment had been accepted. Protestants learned in the 19th century to have the reality of separation, but also to enjoy general, though unofficial, predominance in the culture. Protestants had the happy coincidence in the 19th century of religious liberty and religious ascendancy. Had a happy state of affairs, to be sure. And they were convinced that, by voluntary means, this could be maintained as a Christian nation after their understanding of what a Christian nation was to be. Now, though immigration by mid-19th century was already beginning to change the patterns of religious pluralism in a radical way, for various reasons, this has largely been hidden from American Protestants until after the First World War and later. Actually, of course, immigration reached its peak only in the 20th century, when on no less than 6 occasions in the first 15 years of this century, the annual intake surpassed 1 million souls. Now, the fact that we shifted from essentially the Protestant pluralism of 1789 and 1848, the fact that we shifted from a Protestant to a radical religious pluralism has slowly been dawning upon us ever since. In that high tide of immigration that came to its peak in the years before the First World War, and that high tide of immigration came increasingly large numbers of Roman Catholics, of Jews, of Eastern Orthodox Christians, and of unchurched peoples. The religious map of America, which you can't really draw, but if you could draw today a religious map of America, it shows a pluralistic picture sharply different from the Protestant pluralism of 1789 or of 1848. Besides the many Protestant bodies, there is, of course, the vast Roman Catholic Church, by all odds the largest single church in the nation. And then there are very significant Jewish and Orthodox and Mormon and other concentrations in certain areas, and of course a good-sized body of non-affiliated persons. Now, in this present radically pluralistic situation, a situation which is somewhat difficult for many Protestants to accept, we must remember that many of the specific troubling points in the church-state scene are survivals from earlier periods of Protestant dominance. A recent United Presbyterian statement on relations between church and state passed by the General Assembly several years ago. This statement on church and state put the matter in these words: but a number of specific contemporary problems of church and state are the product of the early Protestant era of American history. Sunday laws, for example, were the creation of Puritan culture. Although held by the Supreme Court to be a safeguard for labor, historical responsibility for Sunday laws lies with the Puritans and their descendants. Tax exemption for church property, clerical exemption from military service, censorship, the use of public property for religious displays, the evaluation of the fitness of candidates for public office on the basis of religious affiliation, and a host of other pressing questions
are the heritage of Protestant predominance in the earlier era of American history. Most of the laws that raised church-state issues in our time are not the product of the massive Catholic immigration of an earlier, but out of an earlier, I'm sorry, are not the product of the massive Catholic immigration, but of an earlier era to which our own tradition, said these Presbyterians, to which our own tradition is akin. Now, in the century and three quarters since the First Amendment was prepared, the area of the country has increased fourfold. The sheer geographical area has increased fourfold. The population of the country has increased nearly 50 times since 1789. And the religious picture has changed from a basically Protestant pluralist to a radical religious pluralist. Yet I believe that the basic guidelines then laid down 175 years ago can continue to serve us in the foreseeable future. On the whole, the First Amendment worked well in a time of Protestant pluralism, Protestant dominance, though it did not perfectly protect religious minorities. Now, it seems to me, in the new situation we're in, we simply are going to have to forego some of the privileges we long retained by sheer weight of numbers and tradition and historical inertia. It seems to me that where practices of the devotional reading of the Bible, as opposed to the academic reading of the Bible, but the practices of the devotional reading of the Bible, especially the King James Version, and of public prayer in the public schools, when these things are challenged, will have to be given up, that the logic of separation demands this. It seems to me that now, for us to contribute to the weakening of the First Amendment, might begin to unravel the fabric of separation and of freedom, so that our church pulpits might ultimately no longer be unquestionably ours to control. I, myself, hesitate from beginning to unravel the logic of separation because it may begin to pinch us at a few points. The principle of religious liberty in the United States has been well served by the practice of the separation of church and state. And to give it up because in a few instances it is uncomfortable to us in a highly pluralistic nation would be, I think, to endanger the principle it is designed to protect. Now, happily, there is deepening devotion to religious liberty by most American Christians. Over 7 years ago, my colleague and now president, John Bennett, said, "It is important to realize that a very able and earnest attempt is being made by Roman Catholic scholars in this country, with much support from Catholics in Western Europe, to change the principles as well as the practice of the church in this matter. These new propositions correspond to views that are held in Europe and which have the support of the Vatican itself." And we anticipate that the forthcoming session of the Second Council is going to pass the schema on religious liberty, which will be a good step in the right direction. Now, for us to weaken our hold on religious liberty and on separation as a means of maintaining it, just as those who for so long seemed unclear on this point are coming around to it, would, I think, be ironic indeed. I think that we should not revise our hold on separation of church and state. So I answer the question of the topic by saying that Baptists should not revise traditional views. If that means weakening the separation of church and state or weakening the First Amendment. But having said that, we do need to be aware of the situation in which we live, aware of the changed religious situation of mid-20th century life, aware of the nature of the conditions of life in a modern, technological, highly pluralistic society. Separation of church and state does not mean separation of religion and culture. It is, you move then into a different realm. Separation of church and state does not mean separation of religion from society. Churches and states exist within the same society. Both are concerned, or should be concerned, with the good of the whole society and with the welfare of all kinds of human beings. In the areas of education, of health, and of welfare, there are areas of overlapping interest for both churches and the state. Now, it seems to me, if we keep clear the principle of religious liberty and the practice of the separation of church and state, then there is room for exploration in these areas. And one reason why I'm concerned to keep the main position clear is so that we can then be free to experiment some in imaginative ways in attempting to meet all kinds of human need in today's world. If we keep the main picture clear, then I think we are free to be creative in confronting some of the difficulties in American life. Last year there was held a national conference on church and state. It was called under the auspices of the National Council of Churches, but it spoke only for itself. But I think its principal conclusion perhaps was this one. Under some well-defined circumstances, government may legitimately support specific programs of church-affiliated health and welfare agencies. The sole purpose of any governmental policy in this respect must be the promotion of a clearly definable public interest as against a private interest of an individual or religious group. That's the end of the quotation. Under certain well-defined circumstances, I think if we keep that definition clear, then we are free for creative experimentation. Now, the important considerations, the statement went on to define, are these. The governmental program must not be aimed primarily at the support of religious institutions or religious objectives. The support of church-affiliated agencies must be an incidental part of a large program directed to appropriate public interest. And the agency must not discriminate on the basis of race, of color, of creed, or of national origin. And furthermore, reversionary clauses must be written to ensure that public funds and buildings purchased by them are not diverted for the public purposes for which they were originally required. Seems to me such well-defined circumstances protect freedom and separation of church and state, but allow churches not to divorce themselves from the culture or the society of which they are a part. Now, the statement goes on to note that public funds for religious schools raises further questions, for such schools are clearly committed to religious instruction and practices. And the statement declares government funds should not be used to support religious teaching. On the other hand, it is the government's role to support education and recognize the constitutional freedom of parental choice. And the statement goes on to point out that possibly what's called shared time or dual school enrollment deserves careful analysis and testing. It does not unqualifiedly support it, but it says it deserves looking at seriously and considerable testing. Now, I am referring to this simply as an illustration that if we keep clear the cardinal principle of religious liberty and the separation of church and state as a means of maintaining and protecting it, then we can move with some imagination into areas of the public good where we have a contribution perhaps to make. I think the present educational bill, H.R. 2362, now before the House, as revised, because the revisions have been important, as revised, would seem to be in keeping with the First Amendment and be worthy of our serious reflection and consideration. The Baptist Joint Committee on Public Affairs has reviewed this proposed measure favorably. Dr. C. Emanuel Carlson, known to many of us, says that the bill does seem to be an honest effort to meet the needs of the day. Now, religious men of all stripes in the United States have a contribution, and an important one, that can be made by no other groups to the common good. A nation needs the loyalty and the constructive criticism of those who have allegiance to a higher power. Religious people have a point of reference beyond the temporal scene which can contribute very much to the health of the nation. States, all states I suspect, tend to absolutize themselves and can then move toward fanaticism. Religious men need freedom in order to follow whatever guiding light illuminates their way. But freedom is indivisible. It must be for all, or finally, it is for none. Now, as Baptists, we need to be concerned, now as we have always been, about the freedom of those whom we oppose theologically. We need to defend their freedom as stoutly as we maintain our own. Out of the encounter of Christian men with the eternal God can come sources of strength for the whole society as we move in society as intelligent citizens. These insights that come out of our wrestle with the ultimate, these insights become corrupted when confused with political instrumentality. It seems to me that separation of church and state protects us all. It protects us, it protects others, and gives us all freedom to seek the best and freedom to follow.
And now unto him who is able to keep us from falling and to present us faultless in his presence on the day of his exceeding glory, be dominion and power, grace and glory, world without end, through Jesus Christ the Lord.